brothers and sisters. Due to bird failure last night, probably there wasn't too many that woke up this morning, early this morning enough to review their word.
We did.
You did? Remember the word? Some of you older ones with the memory problems? Remember the word? Brother Keith, remember that word? You got it taped. That's cheating. Anyway, this morning, and Lord willing this evening, we will be talking about what I consider the subject closest to my heart in these two areas. The unfeigned love of the brethren, and then fellowship par excellence. I don't think there's any limits to the benefits we get by the work we do on this subject area, the love of the brethren. And I'd like to start it off by going and just pondering a little of what our Lord did to develop this kind of bond with the disciples. And the disciples weren't an easy group to bond together. And if you're working on an arranging board and you don't find that bond there now, you find that it's not easy to forge those kinds of relationships, then take a little heart. Luke 9. Now, these were disciples of the Lord. Now, I think some people, maybe most of us at times, feel that if we were witnessing those miracles of the Lord, and we were listening to the testimony from his mouth, how could we be anything but loving, patient disciples? And that's where our reasoning is wrong. Because these disciples were typical humans. They weren't unusual. They weren't different from us. And in verse 46, while they were disciples, then there arose a reasoning among them which of them should be greatest. And quite apart from the miracles, and quite apart from the tempering aspects of the Lord's words, they were still reasoning like men. Which of them should be the greatest? And of course, Jesus reacted to it. And in this particular time, perceiving the thought of their heart, he took a child and set him by him, and said unto them, whosoever shall receive this child in my name receiveth me, and whosoever shall receive me receiveth him that sent me. For he that is least among you all, the same shall be great. And that wasn't sufficient. The Lord worked on this. And there's something wonderful and beautiful about the way the Lord worked with his disciples, because he was so patient with them. It's not, therefore, for us to take advantage of the patience of the Lord and almost say, well, I'm not good enough now, but Lord, just be patient and I will. It's almost, that you take advantage of the situation. But what I mean is, we're so subject to forgetting that probably a week from now there will only be just a very few things that we'll ever remember about this week. Because we are just so subject to forgetting. That's why memory aids are really something practical and worth thinking about. Because this was a problem for all disciples, that you forget. And here they are reasoning who should be the greatest, and the Lord answers them and directs them that the person that's least among you, he shall be great. But that didn't work. Because you go right over to Luke 22, right at the time of the Lord's suffering, when he needed strength the most and encouragement from those, or from any that could encourage him. And the disciples are still thinking the wrong things. So, he's at the table with them. In verse 21, behold, the hand of him that betrayeth me is with me on the table. And truly the Son of Man goeth as it was determined, but woe unto that man by whom he is betrayed. And they began among themselves to inquire among themselves which of them it was that should do this thing. And there was also a strife among them, which of them should be accounted the greatest. Now the first word was a reasoning. It's an understandable thing that they were just reasoning, talking, oh, maybe I'll be the greatest, maybe you'll be the greatest. But now it's a strife. That's a much stronger word. Instead of being tempered by the Lord's comments and backing off on this, they were now getting further along and thinking, who is going to be the greatest? There was a strife among them. Which of them should be accounted the greatest? And he says unto them, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors. But ye shall not be so. But he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he that is chief as he that doth serve. For whether is greater, he that sitteth at meat or he that serveth? Is not he that sitteth at meat? But I am among you as he that serveth. And that was the concept the Lord tried to get across. And of course, we have the added features of the other gospel records of what he actually did as a servant, going around washing their feet, humbling himself as a servant. Now, how do we respond to this, brethren and sisters? Well, just one little area in which we've tried to deal with this is when we set up our ecclesia in Shelburne, we felt that we should make all the offices in the ecclesia have a terminal date. So no one can be in an office forever, so to speak, until he dies in office. There's a term of office. No one can be recording brother for any longer than 2 years. And that function is one that has to rotate amongst the brethren so that no one gets the idea that they are the chief. And no one can have any position in there such that they get this elevated feeling. Not that they immediately would or that anybody necessarily would, but just as a caution so that we all become servants and we all get the experience of serving. And I think we've got to work at that. That does not come easy. This is the natural reaction that even around the table when the Lord is telling them about his impending agony, they're still thinking of who's going to be the greatest, and there's a strife. Now it's an argument. It's not just a reasoning. It's an argument. Who's going to be the greatest? Now that is the way of the flesh. And if we spent 3 years side by side with the Lord, listening to what he's saying and witnessing his miracles, don't expect we'd be any better, because we're flesh too. That's a problem we'll always have to deal with, and we should build in safeguards so that it doesn't happen. So that we don't have this idea of one brother or a group of brethren thinking that they're greater than the others. I'm sure that's a problem in our community if we don't do that. And then in John 21, I mean, the Lord does so much work to try to prepare these brethren. And he does. He is successful. So we have to look at where he was successful. In John 21, now we've hinted at this before, but let's take a little deeper look. We know that the Lord was with them after his resurrection. There was a 40-day period, but yet we don't know just how much of that time he spent with them. The Apostle Paul says he appeared unto 500 brethren. So he obviously wasn't just appearing unto these 12. But neither was he with them all the time. And John 21, it almost seems strange that although they saw this figure on the shore, they didn't immediately know it was the Lord. And yet, the Lord was appearing at a good time. Because in verse 2, there were together Simon, Peter, and Thomas called Didymus, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, and two other of his disciples. And Simon Peter saith unto them, I go a-fishing. And they say unto him, we also go with thee. They went forth and entered into a ship immediately, and that night they caught nothing. Now there's got to be something in those words, they caught nothing. As there is something in the words of the Lord later on when he talks about the disciples and the fish. At least that's what I think he was referring to. They caught nothing because this was not the kind of fishing the Lord had in mind. This was going back to where they were called from. And he wanted them to be busy about fishing for men. And so the Lord performs this miracle. Now it's really kind of puzzling in a sense. These were experienced fishermen. And if they had been toiling all night and hadn't caught anything, And then some, it would seem, stranger from the shore says, have you got anything? And they say, no. Well, just cast on the other side of the boat. Now, what would be the likely response of an experienced fisherman to a stranger on the shore that says, all you got to do is put the nets on the other side of the boat, when they'd been toiling all night and catching nothing? And yet they did. And it doesn't say that there was any argument or any, you know, reservation about that. They cast, therefore, and now they were not able to draw it in for the multitude of fish. So listening to the Lord and doing what he said was having great advantages. But without his direction, they caught nothing. So there was, as there was when they originally listened to the Lord and first heard his call, great advantage in doing what he said. So they came to the shore, and the Lord asked them to bring the fish which they caught. Verse 10, bring of the fish which you have caught. And they went, and they brought 153 fish. And even though there were so many, yet was not the net broken. I don't know what the significance of 153 is. I've never satisfied myself as to what that is. But nevertheless, I can see the picture. The Lord is there talking to them, the disciples are there, and the fish are there. And then after they have eaten, Jesus comes to Simon Peter. Verse 15, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? He saith unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. And he saith unto him, feed my lambs. Now, I think it's important to try to picture the scene. I don't believe that Jesus is saying, Simon Peter, do you love me more than these disciples love me? I don't think that's what the Lord is really saying to him. I think what the Lord is saying, Lord, or Peter, do you love me more than these fish? Are you going to take your brethren fishing? Or are you going to do what I'm requiring of you? Lovest thou me more than these? And the word, of course, is that agape word. And Peter replies with the filioff word. Thou knowest that I love thee. And he saith unto him, feed my lambs. Well, which were the lambs right next to him? Feed my lambs. I suppose Peter was somewhat impressed by that. But then he says to him again, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Same word, agape. And he saith unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I filioli, that's the just the tender affection word, feed my sheep, pasture my sheep, be a shepherd to my sheep. And then the Lord still sees in Peter something that has to be, you know, prepared further. And he says unto him the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, filio, thou me? Now this is a test of Peter. This is really challenging Peter. Well, do you love me even tenderly, Peter? And Peter's grieved now because he realizes the implication of that. Lovest thou me? And he says unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I filio thee. And Jesus saith unto him, feed my sheep. Now, I don't think Peter could walk away from that being unimpressed. Yeah, Peter was a person that may be an impetuous, impulsive, and all the rest of it, but he was also a person who was very honest and sincere. And it would seem by the way he responded in the Acts of the Apostles, he did that. Because he then took the initiative, he represented those apostles to the authorities, and he got through a certain period of time until others were able to rise up and help him in that leadership. Now, I often feel that you really don't get anything out of the Scriptures just seeing the Lord talk to Peter. You've got to see yourself there. And you've got to see yourself in Peter's position. And the Lord's challenging you. He's challenging me. And he's saying, do you love me? Well, if you love me, feed my lambs. Now, look, brother, that's the way we got to see it. This is no good just being an historian and saying, well, he's just talking to Peter, and this is nice to see how Peter reacts. You're Peter, and you're in that scene, and the Lord's saying, do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know we love you. Then feed my lambs. Now, what does he mean, feed my lambs? Well, that's where I think we've got to look a little further. And I think Peter, recognizing that maybe that's not very clearly explained, in his epistle, goes to work on developing what that means. Let's have a look at some of the things he says. First Peter chapter 1. You know, brothers and sisters, we never know. We have a little taste now of just what might happen, you know, with the international scene changing before our eyes. We don't know how much longer we're going to be able to visit each other. You know, it's quite possible we were not even able to do it this time. It could be that a couple years down the road and you people are going to be isolated and we will be isolated and the world's changing. And so we've got to look at this a little more sincerely, a little deeply, more deeply than we've ever looked at it before. He says, feed my sheep. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 22. Seeing you have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit, unto unfeigned love of the brethren, see that you love one another with a pure heart fervently. Now again, it's open-ended. It does not tell us what that means. It just tells us that we should have a special feeling and a special desire to serve our brethren, but doesn't tell us how to do it. And I think we need to be told how to do it. Told, we will go out that door feeling, yes, I've got to do something, but we won't know what to do, and we won't do anything differently. Because I think the instruction has to come to us in a simpler, more practical way than just in sort of these broad statements that we should love the brother. And that's why we have the rest of the Bible. This tells us it's right, but it doesn't tell us how to do it. But it tells us it shouldn't be feigned. And that's an interesting start, because it's not to be acted out. It's not something that, all right, well, if the Lord wants me to do it, I'll do my best and I'll grit my teeth while I do it because I don't like this work. Now, if that's the attitude, then we got a long way to go to really achieve what the Lord wants us to do. It's to be unfeigned, not play acting, sincerely loving the brethren. And as I mentioned before, I can't see that being done when a brother who has an obligation to the meeting to give a paper, whether a Bible class or whether it's a lecture or exhortation, who does not think about this responsibility when he's preparing it. And somebody that saves 5 minutes at the last of the day to put together a talk to give to the brethren to feed them is not thinking about that responsibility. This is giving feed or pasture according to the needs. Now I think about this with a flock back home. And quite often back home, because the summer brings on different weather conditions, and the first part of it is quite wet, and then you go through a dry period, and then you go through a period where grasses naturally die out. Like some grasses are good spring grasses, and some are summer grasses, and some are fall grasses, and you've got to watch your pasture for your cattle. Any farmer didn't do that in my business, in the cow-calf business, is just setting himself up to lose the next calf crop. Because what happens, after a cow has given birth to a calf, she has about, oh, I'd say about 3 months, and then she's rebred. And for beef cattle, that's usually all with pasture breeding. Whereas you run the bull with the herd, and he runs there for maybe 2 months. And you try to get all your calves coming at once. You want all the calves, in our case, born in April. Some born in May, that's fine. But when they're born in June, July, and August, that creates a lot of problems for a farmer who's trying to get cattle all the same size. If the small ones always suffer. So you're watching your pasture all the time, and you're hoping that there's always enough growth there so that the cows have proper nutrition. Because if they don't have proper nutrition, they don't cycle. And if they don't cycle, they can't be bred. And if they aren't bred that month that they're supposed to be, then the calf comes a month later. And if they're not bred that month, it's a month later, and you have all kinds of problems. So you have to make sure that at the appropriate time, they have the appropriate feed, and everything's there. And it's just a matter of watching the ground and maybe bring them into a new field and making sure what you have planted there so it's got the proper nutrients. And I think that's just exactly the way it is in the Ecclesia. No, so there's a problem in the meeting, and the brother gives an exhortation on something totally unrelated. Now, it's not that young brethren get up there and exhort and hammer away at the Ecclesia, telling them what they should or shouldn't do. It's an appropriate thing that a young brother usually speaks in an encouraging way to the Ecclesia. That's the main thing young brethren can offer in Ecclesia. Not not advice right away on how to handle the most difficult problem in the ecclesia. Save that for the brethren who have the experience. But a young brother can get up there, and what he has that many other brethren don't have is the enthusiasm of finding the truth and living the truth. And with his vitality and hopefully contagious enthusiasm, everybody goes out having had a meal and having benefited by it. But coming to a Bible class where the topic and where the preparation is deadly, that's not performing the will of the Lord, and that's not loving the brethren. Because as you can see, lovest thou me, feed my sheep. We want the practical way to fulfill loving the brotherhood, feed my sheep, and how much more appropriately according to their need. Look at the second chapter at verse 17. You can see how Peter is constantly thinking this, and maybe he's reflecting upon the time they spent disputing who would be the greatest and how they could have maybe more profitably spent that time. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Well, now really that's saying the same thing, but it's a little different. It's one of the reasons why I'm here is because of that verse. Because I have a lot of obligations back in my own ecclesia, and I have a family, and there's all kinds of reasons I could have stayed at home. But we've got to love the brotherhood. Brethren that have come from here, that have come from Australia, that have come from England, have come into our ecclesia, have done me a great service. Because although I've been telling my children what I believe and what my wife believes, and we sit around the table, sometimes they're never impressed until a stranger, brother and sister, but a stranger comes into our house and says the same thing. Then they're impressed. Strangely, that's the way it works. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying anything different. But just because a different voice, different background says it, they finally get fed. So this loving the brotherhood, to me, is loving the brotherhood. It's not just working in ecclesia. It's as we have occasion and have opportunity, we serve the brotherhood. Now, I don't know if any of you brethren or sisters work in a union shop. But if you do, you know what a brotherhood means to the world. Now, I worked as a teacher in a union shop without belonging to the union. But I got all the union correspondence. And I almost was sick when I read that stuff. It always started off, dear brothers and sisters. This was the union shop. Now you can just imagine, if you're a member of that union, and you're receiving the correspondence from a union like that, where they're very militant at times, dear brother or sister. Now, that's got nothing to do with us. We have no part of a brotherhood based on those principles, which is basically greed, where they have bled companies to the point where the company's gone out of business, knowingly that if they got that contract, the company could not operate, could no longer compete, and they still went after it. And everybody gets laid off, the company shuts down. Now that's greed. We do not have that brotherhood. We have a completely different brotherhood where we're really looking out for the needs of one another. And we're not, as we would say, the leeches of society who are only really being fed by the blood of others. Now we're looking by the standards of the word at how we can feed and love the brotherhood. In the fifth chapter, 1 Peter. Now this brings up another little subject area which I have observed here, and it's quite different where you go. Verse 14, greet you one another with a kiss of charity, or a holy kiss. Now, I don't see that to be too customary here, that you greet one another with a kiss. There is the odd person or two that would do that, but I don't see that to be too commonly done. Now, back in America or back anywhere I've been, that just depends. Wherever you've been as to how that's performed. But I think it's important to understand that it's a kiss of agape. Now, it's a bond that we have. In some cases, brothers and sisters are so cold, you know, you get fingers. You don't even get a hand. You get fingers. And I don't think that's right. I mean, a real good handshake between brethren is an illustration of the warmth that we have And even though it's maybe the Russians like to bear hug each other, it's not bad to, you know, hug each other sometimes. We don't have to be a communist, you know, to actually hug our brethren and show our feelings. In our ecclesia, most of the brethren kiss the sisters on a Sunday morning. Now, you have to be careful. I think the brethren are careful. It's just a kiss of love. It's a kiss whereby we greet one another. And after an ecclesia does that, then you have to watch it that you don't miss somebody, because, you know, people think, well, they don't love me anymore. So it does create its problems. But I think it's far better to be warmer with each other than colder with each other. And we've got to be a little less sensitive that if somebody did not greet us with a kiss, it's not because they hate us. It's probably because they forgot us or we got a cold, you know, which has its own problems. In our ecclesia, I think that's helped, or especially with the people that have newly come into the faith, where they have been greeted by the brethren and by the sisters very warmly, and they really felt part of the ecclesia. You know, it's a small thing. It doesn't do anything for their understanding, but that's a good idea, to give one another a kiss of love, to show our relationship and the warmth of it. If you go over to chapter 3 that we read in verse 8, finally, be you all of one mind. Now, the apostle gives us a lot of instruction in this little area, so we'll take this little by little. Be you all of one mind. But we're not all of one mind, brethren. And the first time we get a problem in our meeting, we sure discover it, that we're not all of one mind. So how can you be all of one mind? Well, if you all be my mind, that's fine. But I don't want to be all of your mind. I don't agree with it. That's the kind of problems we have. So how do you solve that? Well, and I mentioned this to a number of you, and I think it's at least a safe way to go, if it's not exactly what the apostle said. And we've had some pretty difficult problems to handle in our ecclesia around the arranging board, and one thing we've all agreed on before we would start in these things, that we're going to remain of one mind. In other words, the democratic way is, all right, majority vote goes. But if you have a sizable minority, you're setting yourself up for real problems in an ecclesia. So we say, look, it's going to be unanimous. And we're not going to stop until it is unanimous. Now that just means that you got to spend a little extra time at it. Maybe another week, maybe another 2 or 3 weeks of meeting on this problem until the brethren are unanimous in what they do. And I really think there's a lot to be said for that. He does not say majority mind, he says one mind. And so when we come to dealing with problems in the ecclesia, we should resolve, first of all, before we even open the subject, that we're going to end on one mind. And we all remember that. We talk it up one to another. We come in one mind, we're going to go out one mind. And we don't stop until it is. And if we can't be of one mind, then we do something else. Like if there's some problem with somebody coming into our ecclesia, he asks for membership in our ecclesia, and we cannot agree as to how that brother, then we should agree that if that is the case, then the brother does not come in or the sister does not come into the meeting. No one has a right, so to speak, and people talk in terms of rights today, to split an ecclesia. Nobody has that right. And anybody who is really sincere about their belief would never want to, never ever want to split an ecclesia. Far better do something else than come into ecclesia and split it. So let's think of that. That before we start, we are committed to being of one mind, unanimous in our decisions, having compassion one of another. Now, I often think that the Apostle Peter would not have learned that from his fellow disciples. You know, when you're disputing around the table of the Lord, and he's thinking of his impending crucifixion, and he's talking about the things that it's going to really cause tremendous upheaval in that little group, and they're thinking, who's going to be the greatest? That's common, brethren and sisters, and quite often I've found, when I come to a ranging meeting, ranging meetings sometimes are very hard to meet. You've got to rush home, you rush through this, you rush through that, and you end up, and you're just not prepared for that meeting at all. And you're very vulnerable. The whole meeting is very vulnerable. To have compassion one of another really takes a mental preparation, because you've got to allow for differences. You've got to allow for the fact that your brethren may not be where you are, and you may not be where they are. But quite often we don't see that compassion. As I said yesterday, I think the standard of compassion is the Lord crucified, being taunted by the people standing all around him, and he says, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." Now that is a tremendous presence of mind. A person who could see that, look, what's happening here is nothing in the sight of the Father, because he's fully in control of this, and it's not going to change history. And if I continue on my way, I'm still going to go through to the joy that was set before him. And so he can, with that presence of mind, be compassionate. When we lose that presence of mind, we start thinking this little item we're discussing is the biggest thing in the world, then we have this strife that quite often arises between brethren. We need to manifest the love of the brethren, not the strife. Love as brethren. You know, Peter said this so many times, you can't help but be impressed that he wanted to say that. That this was one of the things that meant so much to him now. Love the brethren, be built together, be pitiful, be courteous. And that word pitiful, again, like the Lord, you know, these people don't know what they're doing. So I can forgive them. It's you know, we immediately think sometimes with a suspicious mind that people are full of malice. What they do was out of malice. They made that comment because they were trying to hurt me, trying to cut me, because they dislike me. Well, the opposite to that feeling, which is rather natural, is to feel pity for a person who makes a comment that's so out of keeping with the word of the Lord. You feel pity for that person, that they would say something like that. Not that you have to immediately say, well, I feel sorry for you. You don't have to do that, because you know that's not going to help the situation, but you should feel that way so that you're not offended by it. And you can still remain calm and collected and respond in a way that will help your brother instead of revile for reviling. That's not the way our Lord told us to suffer. So we go on. Not rendering evil for evil, or railing for railing, but contrariwise blessing. You know, I grew up in an ecclesia as a boy to about 12 years old. We left that ecclesia and went somewhere else. But that first ecclesia was almost unbelievable in the way, the rapport the brethren had with one another. Now, they were a real rough sort. All of those brethren had gone through the Depression. They really knew what toughness was. But they were tough on each other. And you listen to them discussing something, it was like a big row all the time. But they seemed to know how to handle it. They could argue, they could yell, they could shout at each other and walk away friends. But boy, everybody else got wounded just by listening to it. It was like a war going on. And I remember as a young person almost being terrified by what I heard. Well, you look back on that ecclesia and you say, well, they walked out friends from those meetings because that's what they were used to. But boy, looking back on it, there's a number of those people aren't in the truth today. That's not following the Lord's admonition. We've got to be very careful to follow it. You know, if we have those kinds of meetings, brethren, whether it's arranging meetings or anything else, where we find that sometimes we lose our cool, then we should take a verse or two like this and say, well, we'll always meet in this room, and put it in big enough letters so that we can all see it. And so we just remind each other now and then of what the Lord's words are. Because surely that is the basic problem. We can be humbled by them, but we don't think of them. And if they don't come into our mind, it's not long before the situation gets out of hand. And I think that can only be very destructive, if not in the short term, certainly in the long term. So he goes on. Not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing, but contrariwise blessing, knowing that you are thereunto called, that you should inherit a blessing. Well, what blessing? Well, he does go on to specify a blessing, because he says, he that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips that they speak no guile. Let him eschew evil and do good, let him seek peace and ensue it. That's the person that wants long life. And I'm sure there's not a person here that would disagree. Our problem is the little member between our teeth. And we talk too much. We say things out of hand. Our tongue gets us into difficulties. As James says, if we can control that tongue, it's like controlling a great big ship with that little rudder. You know, it's like that little match that lights the huge forest fire. That's what the tongue does. But in return, if you go back to the book of Proverbs, you may remember the number of proverbs that speak about a word that's spoken in season, how good it is. Like, you know, just coming down the garden path and the person's been up all night, a bird kept them awake, you know, and someone says, well, good morning to you, and I have a good sleep, and a smile, and that, you feel good already. Forget about the bird. You know, there's all kinds of little things that can upset somebody, or another little thing can calm them down. And those little things don't take much. It's not much of a price expended to any of us to say a good word. And even though you may not feel like saying a good word, force yourself to say a good word, and sometimes you feel better by the fact you've actually said something good too. Little things like that mean so much. And yet sometimes the human behavior is, we just don't exhibit them. Now, Matthew 18. Here's Peter again, asking the Lord. And I suppose he had a problem with one of the disciples, he had a problem with somebody, or maybe even some of the disciples put Peter up to it, because he would be the one that would talk, so Peter, ask this. That wouldn't be unique either with Peter's life. Verse 21, Matthew 18. Then came Peter to him and said, Lord, how oft shall I, my brother, sin against me and I forgive him? Till seven times? And Jesus saith unto him, I say not unto thee until seven times, but until 70 times seven. Now then the Lord goes on and speaks a parable. Good for Peter. Now if he didn't say that, maybe we wouldn't have the parable. Really good that we have people like Peter. It's really good that we have young people. I really enjoyed the young people. They ask questions. If you don't have ask questions, how do you get answers? You've got to ask questions. You've got to ask. The Bible tells us to ask, to seek, to knock, to search. All these things are good. Peter asked the question, and the Lord gives us a wonderful answer. You're not supposed to notch something in your house as to how many times you've forgiven a person, and when you get to 490, you don't forgive them anymore. I don't think that's what the Lord is saying. He's saying, you just remember how many times your Father in heaven forgives you. That's the sentiments of the parable. And as he says in the Lord's Prayer, you know, we seek forgiveness as we forgive others. So that's very important that we have that relationship with our brethren and sisters if we need to have that relationship. Let's go back to 1 Peter chapter 4. Now there's really quite an important point here. I felt much better having done a little research on this to try to figure out just what this meant. 1 Peter 4, verse 7. It says, the end of all things is at hand. Be you therefore sober and watch unto prayer. And above all things have fervent charity among yourselves. For charity shall cover the multitude of sins. Have fervent agape among yourselves, that self-sacrificing kind of love, where you give up yourself to serve one another, that kind of love. For that kind of love shall cover the multitude of sins. And the question I ask myself is, whose sins? Whose sins get covered? Is it the sins of the person who is manifesting the love? Or is it the person's sins that you manifest the love to? How do we understand this? I can't understand that. It doesn't make sense to me. It says something which I would acknowledge is true, but I don't know how to apply it. I don't know who benefits from it. Charity covers the multitude of sins. So we look at our concordance. We find that's not the only time that's said. If you go back to James, that occurs in James. In James, the 5th chapter, verse 19. Brethren, if any of you do err from the truth, and one convert him, Let him know that he which converteth the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins. Who sins? The sinner sins. Well, how do we manifest this love then? If any of you do err from the truth and one convert him. Now that's practical. I can understand that, and that's very helpful. What it means then, if you want to know how to love your brother, and one of the things you've got to do, if someone errs, you go to that brother or that sister and you try to bring them back to the fold. You try to bring them back into favor with the Lord again. And if you do, a multitude of sins, their sins is covered. So this love is not just this wishy-washy thing that's talked about in evangelical circles. You can never get a handle on what people really mean. You should love one another. No, it's got real practical applications firmly pointed out to us in the Scripture. That this word love is one of the most difficult things to do. Because the person that has to go to the one that's in error has got a very difficult task. He's not talking about forgiveness. Like some people just think, well, I mean, just forgive him. You're not forgiving him, you're converting him. That's much more difficult. You've got to show him he's wrong. You've got to get him away from that error and bring him back into the truth and not offend a whole bunch of other people doing it. Let him know that he which converteth the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins. Now anybody who's in technology in the maintenance area will know that people really have started to progress in the area of maintenance when they get into the area of preventive maintenance. Now, it's one thing to have a guy in his shop and he's got all the tools and nothing ever happens until something breaks in the plant. Then he rushes out to try and fix it, but while he's fixing it, the whole thing shut down. So a company said, well, we can't afford that shutdown because that's costing us too much money. So what we're going to do is we're going to get a plan of preventive maintenance. Instead of having this chap sit here until something happens, we're going to get him on a roster. So he's going to go around, and maybe some other people go around too, and we're going to check everything to try to prevent these breakdowns. Preventive maintenance. Now think of how we can apply that in the truth. Now here's a brother, you see something's happened. He's brought this person in. It doesn't look good. Let's hope he straightens it out. No one says a word. And he keeps bringing this other person in. You know, a person, he's in the truth and she's not in the truth, just as an example. That's not right. No one does anything. Next thing you know, she's wearing a ring. Uh-oh. Now someone says something, but what are you going to say now? That's not preventive maintenance. That's maintenance when you've got a problem. That's a shutdown condition. We don't do that in industry, so why do we do it in the truth? You see, this love of the brethren is not forgiving. You don't say, well, I'll manifest my love to this brother and forgive him. You're not converting that sinner from the way of death. He's still going to die in his sins. And loving him is the very wrong thing you can do if you think that's love, just forgiving a sinner. God forgives sinners. We got to convert a sinner. So, take the idea, beautiful idea, that God tells Ezekiel. Very practical. You can really get a handle on this. You can understand how you can be what Ezekiel was to Israel. Verse 7. I don't take much time in this because it's a little aside. But Ezekiel 33, verse 7. So thou, O son of man, I have set thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore thou shalt hear the word at my mouth and warn them from me. When I say unto the wicked, O wicked man, thou shalt surely die. If thou dost not speak to warn the wicked from his way, all that wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thine hand. Nevertheless, if thou warn the wicked of his way to turn from it, if he do not turn from his way, he shall die in his iniquity, but thou hast delivered thy soul. That's what we've got to be, brothers and sisters. And you don't have to be an arranging brother. A sister could do that. That's a commitment upon all of us who want to be kings and priests in the kingdom. That when you see trouble on the horizon, not right up against the gates, but trouble on the horizon, you go to that brother, you go to that sister and say, look, you know what you're doing. You know what the Bible says about that. You don't tell them, hey, you can't bring that person anymore, but you warn them. Without that warning, don't think that we're sitting in the congregation without guilt concerning what's happened. Because the Lord says, if you don't warn them, their blood's upon your head. Now that's a warning to all of us, not just to the sinner. But going back to Peter, he's saying that loving the brother, in the words that were found in the parallel passage in James, is converting a sinner from the way of death. Now, brethren and sisters, you know in your own ecclesia many things, and I know in my ecclesia many things, and you know what that means. So we see these things developing in the ecclesia. We've got to do what is very hard to do. Get down and sit down and love with that brother and that sister. Look, do you really realize what you're doing? And try to convert that sinner, if it does lead into sin, from the error of their way. 2 Peter chapter 1. Now just how high ranking is this love of the brethren in the estimation of God? I mean, there's all kinds of other virtues that we have to have. How high ranking is it? We know that agape is number one. But agape is such a composite quality that no one can say, well, I've got agape, without saying you're perfect, because that's the kind of quality it is. It encompasses everything, agape. It's greater than faith, the love, and all those, because it encompasses everything. So that's always the pinnacle. But notice what he says in verse 5. Besides this, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and to knowledge temperance, and to temperance patience, and to patience godliness, and to godliness brotherly kindness. Look at how high ranking brotherly kindness is in that progression. Now that tells me two things. First of all, it tells me that's how important it is in God's eyes. And secondly, how hard it is to attain it. Love of the brethren is not easy to attain, whether it's on a tender affection level of filial, or whether it's the self-sacrificing type of agape. It's not easy to achieve. So a person has to go through stages of faith and adding knowledge of understanding and performance to another level of understanding and performance. And brotherly love is not easy to achieve. You know, it's Cain that said, am I my brother's keeper? And a lot of people echo it. Really to themselves, honestly in their heart, they echo it. Am I really my brother's keeper? And this is exactly what we're talking about. This is what Peter's trying to tell us. This is what the Lord was trying to tell Peter. We are our brother's keeper. And we've got to love that brother and that sister with all the effort that we can possibly put forward to them. Now, I look for practical things, brother and sister. I'm very oriented that way, as you probably found out. And I try to find things that can make me understand some of these general subjects, which I must say I don't understand. I just don't benefit. It says love the brotherhood. All right, I say I should love the brotherhood, but I walk out not edified because I don't know what it means. But when you see what James says, you've got to convert a sinner from his way. That's loving. Then all right, I can say now at least I have that. But look at this. Go to 1 Timothy chapter 3. Here's another thing that constitutes love of the brother. And it was a requirement for anybody who was to be an overseer of the ecclesia. Now it talked about being vigilant, being sober, being, you know, in behavior impeccable, so that no one could ever find a fault in you. And we shudder when we think of the high standards that God expects of us and where we come in attaining them. But given to hospitality. Given to hospitality. 1 Timothy 3 in verse 2, just towards the end of it. He should be given to hospitality. And to emphasize it, if you looked at the parallel passage in Titus, where it talks about the things that elders should be, again it emphasizes this aspect of hospitality. Verse 8, a lover of hospitality. Now why would we be a lover of hospitality? I mean, some people just love to be hospitable. And you don't have to be any knowledge of the truth at all to be hospitable. I suppose that many world religions, you find that it's almost characteristic of them to be hospitable. Why should we be that way? What advantage is it to us? Well, when we talk about doing good to one another, it's quite obvious. If we read in the Word of God, He tells us it's not to be good and be hospitable to people who can return it. That's number one. There really isn't any advantage in just having return visits. Although I suppose there is some and you get to know the person. What he really wants to do is to be hospitable to those who need that hospitality. People who you don't like, you don't naturally gravitate towards. Their personalities are abrasive. They maybe have a different outlook on prophecy. They maybe have some different understanding of some other feature, which you just don't naturally move towards them. You be hospitable to those. There's nothing I found more binding of brethren together than to sit down and eat together. Brethren and sisters love to eat. You know, after Sunday school, we have something to eat. After Bible class, we have something to eat. After Sunday night lecture, we have something to eat, and we have all kinds of meals together on Sunday afternoon. I've never found anything can bring the ecclesia together more than that. Eating. Now, we have a few problems with cookies because, some sisters have maybe better cooks and they have... So we're trying to develop a standard ecclesial cookie because this is causing a little problem. We probably will never agree on what that is, but we're looking for one so that we can just have standard cookies instead of having these, there's some... Sisters bring these really hot things. We call them fire sticks. You can only eat three or four of them, and you go home and you're warm enough for the rest of the night. And there's others that have these real syrupy ones. Boy, I tell you, you don't need any more sugar for the rest of the week. But eating together has done more for our ecclesia than anything else I know of. You can sit down and you can talk to the brother who disagrees with you across the table, and you find, hey, we really like each other after all. Yeah, we do disagree on some things, and we work our way out little by little. But we never allow a barrier of not visiting each other to get in that way. This idea, well, I don't really like you, so I'm not going to invite you to my house. In a lot of cases, people can invite you to the house because their house just isn't suitable for inviting. Now, if I invite people to my house, they better be strong. Because I got about three or four kids that just love to test anybody that comes in that door. And they jump on them and they wrestle them and the poor guy staggers. I'm glad this is over. That's not exactly what I think they mean by being hospitable. So at the ecclesia is the ideal place for us to have a meal. And some of you that have your own ecclesial halls, I think you should really try to practice that. It has a tremendous effect on bringing brothers and sisters together where we can eat together. And it gives us the time to carefully go over our relationship with each other and build it. Now, if that results in little clicks, and obviously it's useless. Every time you have an ecclesial dinner, that group sits there and that group sits there, you just gotta force yourself to go around and mix with everybody. Get to know everybody in the ecclesia. Don't leave anybody out. And now that's work that will repay you great dividends. Great dividends. If you spend that little time getting to know everybody and making sure that, you sit across the table from somebody else this time. And, it's this old sister that you have a hard time with and she doesn't remember things very well and she talks all the time. Well, that's all right. Let her have a go at you. I think most brethren are tough enough to take that now and then. How are we doing for time? A few minutes? Good. Okay, I'd like to, just leave a few things out here. We turn to 2 Timothy chapter 4. Now, I've mentioned this, and I'd like to emphasize it now. I mentioned this before, but boy, this to me is a critical thing. I'm very pleased being here to see our young people because, our ecclesia is where there are none. And the reasons there are none is because they never cared for the young people. So they're to blame. But what a tragedy not to have young people. In 2 Peter chapter 4, verse 4, it talks about, verse 3 and 4, it talks about the time would come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts, they would heap to themselves teachers having itching ears, and they would be turned away from their they would turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned unto fables. Now, very wisely, Christadelphians, and this is our heritage, we have not had paid ministers. Even though a person could go to the scriptures, like the Apostle Paul explained, that you don't muzzle the ox that treads out the corn. But nevertheless, we've said no paid ministers. Now, in America, they're getting very close to this, and I see this as a danger point, and I really am worried about it. They are now having domestic missionaries. You ever heard that? A domestic missionary? Where they'll take a young brother or a young sister, and they'll bring them into an ecclesial area, and they will look after all their expenses, and they look after all the contacts. That's got a lot of dangers. That's just one step. Not there yet, but it's one step close to where this is. Where someone else does our work for us. That should never happen. The young people are not the ones that do our work. We're the ones that do the work. When it comes to a campaign, I don't think unbaptized people should be out there taking leaflets. They don't represent the truth. It's the baptized ones that represent the truth. They should be out there going around that route, taking the information, the invitations to people. The kids are done this because really it's a cop-out in the older people. And you look around the world, it doesn't matter how old you are, brothers and sisters. It doesn't matter if you're able to walk. There's examples in this world where people that old are taking leaflets by the hundreds and trying to get people interested in the truth. And that example is a very important one for the youth. Letting the youth do it all, and especially the unbaptized, to my mind, is not right. And so we work together on trying to establish and get away from this idea that anyone or any one part of the ecclesia should do that kind of work, just like we would stay away from a paid ministry. You can see how so many religions have fallen victim to that. If I'm your minister, well, I might tell you a few hard things. Well, I'll tell you a few good things, too, so you'll want me to come back. And if you're paying me and I need a little raise, well, I'll have to give subtle hints now and then. But I won't tell you anything bad during that time because I'm looking for, some reinforcement. And that bait, no wonder the shipwreck all around us, and people have just left the truth because, if I'm going to be hard on you, then you're naturally, as the flesh goes, going to be a little hard on me. Yeah, we'll treat that guy right. He'll have a couple days next week when he'll have to run around and try and find something to eat. That's the natural reaction. So I'll tell you some real nice things, and then maybe you'll invite me out to your house or give me enough to go to a restaurant. And you can see how the things develop. And we've stayed away from that, and very wisely stayed away from that. But look at the other side of that coin. If we don't have someone doing the work, then who is? If there isn't somebody that's doing the study, that's really making this ecclesia grow, then who is doing the work? And if you think Brother X is doing it and Brother X thinks you're doing it, then you still ask the question, but who is doing the work? That's why I say if you get these Bible classes and exhortations and that, when you find that, I don't really think that brother did much preparation. This was like unboiled potatoes, and they're pretty hard to chew down. And he burnt the things to a crisp, and you're jawbreakers, as we call them back home. These kinds of things that brethren give us sometimes, which indicate to everybody, and even the old sisters walk out saying, we didn't get much tonight. If we have to quit our job to do a better job in the ecclesia, I think that's a price worth paying. After all, what are we really in it this for? It's everything to us. And so everything must be secondary. But look at 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2. Look at this extra aspect to that. And the things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also. Now, if you don't have a paid ministry and you don't go that route, then you have to go this route. You have to be very careful that someone in the ecclesia is feeding the ecclesia. Not someone, some number of brethren are feeding the ecclesia. And that you then look in your ecclesia to develop and nurture the growth of young ones who will feed you later on. Now that often doesn't happen. Because no one's got the responsibility. No one is given the job to make sure that someone else 10 years down the road will be able to do it. There's no function in the ecclesia for that. So we all have to work on it, and we have to encourage it. I think, brothers and sisters, we can't help but benefit by just one strong brother or sister in the ecclesia. We all benefit. You know, if I know that when my children go to CYC, there's a brother up there who is just dedicated to CYC, and they're really going to get a good meal up there, I feel a lot better by that. And I benefit, because someone in the ecclesia is really doing something. And if, on the other hand, he can't work in everything, and someone gives a fantastic lecture, really opened up the scriptures and, you know, put the time and visual aids in and fed us well, you think, boy, we're happy we got that brother. That's great, because we really can go on. But no one's assigned those jobs. See, no one's given the job to be the brother or the sister. Someone's got to volunteer. In work back home, I've found that wherever you have a good program in a college, it's always because there's a dedicated person somewhere. Always. It never just happens. It's not because, you know, that's where everything's going out there in industry. In some of the cases where the industry is the liveliest, we have the worst program because we have a dud at the controls. We've got to get people turned on fire on the truth. And that's something which I say is nobody's job. It's all of our job. And just to conclude, maybe we should have left a little more time for this, because though I think we've spoken a fair amount in this vein, Peter goes on in this fifth chapter to speak about elders, the arranging brethren, the ones who are leading the ecclesia. He says, the elders which are among you, I exhort. Now he's taken just that section, the elders. And I'm also an elder, he says, and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Feed the flock of God. And what did Jesus say to him? Feed my lambs. Feed my sheep. That's an important consideration, brothers and sisters. Which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not to get paid for it, not to look for something in return from the community, but willingly desire to feed the flock, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind, and not as lords over God's heritage, but in samples to the flock. Wonderful lessons. When the chief shepherd shall appear, ye shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away.